There's a legal case in the works right now where you have a group of young people, we're talking teenagers mostly when this was first filed, who are suing the federal government over climate change. It's a case called Juliana versus the United States. And the case they're making, the legal strategy, goes like this. Because the government, you know, the Congress and these different presidential administrations, because they haven't done anything meaningful to stop the climate crisis, they violated the constitutional rights of these kids, the rights to life and liberty, the basics. The case is the centerpiece of a documentary film called Youth v. Gov. It's the latest in our film series, so we're going to be talking about it today. But this isn't the only case making this argument. There's an organization called Our Children's Trust that has a team of legal experts trying this strategy actually all over the country, including here in Utah. Julia Olson, who's featured in the documentary, is the lead lawyer.
For years, we've had young people in Utah reaching out to us and interested in joining the campaign that's happening around the country and globally of youth to hold their governments accountable for the actions they're taking that are perpetuating the climate crisis. We've been working for a while now to develop this case, and I think Utahns will see it filed this year. And there's still an opportunity, actually, for young people in Utah to connect with us and get involved. The place to do that is ourchildrenstrust.org/Utah. We look to the rights that youth hold, and typically those are found under the Constitution. And so the Utah Constitution, like other constitutions, protects young people's rights to life and liberty, their freedom. And implicit in that is really their right to have their health protected. One thing that is really incredible in Utah is that not only is the fossil fuel pollution causing the climate crisis, but the air pollution from fossil fuels in Utah is shortening people's lives significantly. Those pollutants that people are breathing in is causing people to lose a year of their life or 5 years of their life. It's also causing a lot of economic harm in the state, and children and young people really bear the brunt of that burden. So some youth we represent certainly have those issues. Others are suffering harms associated with diminishing snowpack in the state and decreasing availability of water in the drought conditions. It impacts agriculture and ranching. So that will be a really important and central part of the case as well. You know, when a government knowingly promotes an activity that is putting young people, children, in harm's way, when a government knowingly does that, it's accountable under the Constitution. And so we talk a lot about protecting young people and kids, but adults are not always so great at that. And here we have a situation where the single biggest threat to children's lives today and their ability to live here safely is the climate crisis. And they know it. And yet they are the group of people in our country who cannot go to the polls and vote. They do not have money to lobby their politicians. And so the one place in our democracy where these kids can have a true voice and have their pleas for justice and their lives heard is in our courts. And so it's our job as attorneys to represent these young people and provide legal services to them at a time when their lives are threatened.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Julia Olson is with us this hour to explain the strategy she's developed that is focused on the history of the government's failed attempts to deal with climate change. But it's also centered on the role of young people. The filmmaker Christy Cooper is also with us. She tells the story of the legal maneuvering in this case and the profiles of some of the kids involved. The film is called Youth v. Gov. We're going to be screening it next week as part of our documentary series. We'll give you details about that here in a moment. We're going to start with Julia Olson and one of the arguments that they're making in the case, that not only has the government failed to act on climate change, it's actively been involved in doing harm.
It really is the government for decades, at least since the 1960s, has taken a prominent role in creating and perpetuating the way we consume energy in our country and what sources that energy. And government has chosen to place its money and its power towards supporting the fossil fuel industry. And that has led all of us, the majority of Americans, to become really reliant upon fossil energy. And that action was taken at the same time that the government knew that by burning fossil fuels, we would catastrophically threaten the well-being of people and the natural world. And so it, you know, it's really affirmative conduct by government that has been harming people.
Yeah. The idea of affirmative conduct is a really critical point in this case. The idea that the government itself didn't just passively let this happen, but actually took part in subsidizing the system, in some cases promoting the system. And I'm wondering, Julie, is that a particularly novel approach? You challenging that? Are you making that case?
It's really the first time that argument has been made in a rights-based framework. So really looking at the constitutional rights that people hold, and including young people, that argument has never been made before. And it's now being made, of course, in the U.S., but also around the world.
There's a moment in the film where we see a judge. This is during a hearing. And he asks you, Julia, whether young people are harmed in a different way, you know, from the grown-ups. And you talk about how you say to the judge that there is this distinction. I wanted to have you say something about that, because I think this gets us to the importance of telling the story from the perspective of young people, their age being an important part of the argument. How do you respond to the judge and that idea?
That was a really a big moment in that oral argument. And what you see in the film is there was a lot of back and forth, but if you watch the oral argument, I was getting hammered by this judge, question after question, and he wouldn't let me finish my sentences. And so at the moment when he asked why children, I said to him very directly that they would live longer than he would.
Yeah.
And it was, you know, perhaps not my best advocacy moment as a respectful attorney, but also it was a really true moment. And not only will children live far longer than adults, but they're also physiologically different, and they bear the burdens of climate pollution and climate crisis harms more so than adults do.
Age is important here. Let me ask you both then. What is the difference in the way young people are thinking about these issues, talking about them, fighting them from the grown-ups? What's the difference there?
I think adults are really bad at thinking about policy and law in a way that is truly protective of children. And children don't have political power. You know, the reality is they can march in the street and they can yell at the top of their lungs, but they can't vote and they don't have the money to lobby politicians. Mm-hmm. So they're at a real disadvantage. And you know, what many courts have been saying is, well, go convince your parents. And that's really diminishing their rights as citizens in our country.
I would also add that, you know, I think my experience in following these young people over so many years and seeing how they are approaching this issue is they see this as very much a problem of justice. This is about what's right and what's wrong. And they don't have the political blinders that we older people often have, where we're looking at everything through political lenses. They really are looking at this in terms of what is right, and how should people be treated, and how should their government be protecting them, and what kind of future do they deserve to have? And it's very much with this, you know, lens of justice that I think is really refreshing. It's a really refreshing way to look at, what protecting our future means.
Well, as one of the young plaintiffs puts it later in the film, we've run out of options. And I think as a young person saying that, knowing that their future is going to be different from, frankly, my future as an older man, it really is a profound thing to say.
Yeah, it is. It's very devastating, you know, to think of that they know that the time is running out. And in many cases, as Julia said, they don't have the political power. Many of them can't vote. To some degree, the courts could be their only option the judicial system could be their only option in actually adequately and urgently enough addressing this issue.
Julia, when did you start thinking about working with young people? Is it something that you strategized, that you thought about, that you thought, oh, this is a good mechanism for getting this accomplished? How did that happen?
It was after I had children myself that my eyes really turned towards the next generation and the generations that will come after us. And I think, you become a parent and you start thinking about what legacy are we leaving and what does their world look like? And then it was a confluence of meeting and talking with Professor Mary Wood, who's one of the scholars who has developed a lot of the legal theory that we have worked with in our cases. I met Dr. James Hansen, who was actively working with young people on climate. And then I met some amazing youth activists who were starting organizations. And when they heard about these ideas of bringing cases, they said, oh, I want to be a plaintiff. And so it really just all came together through a confluence of conversations and becoming a mother.
Christopher, what about you? How did you, have you been thinking about young people and the role they play in advocacy for a while?
I was introduced to youth activism in 2011, actually, with Julia. I was in grad school at the time getting my MFA in science and natural history filmmaking, and I joined a project that was a joint project with MSU, with Montana State University, with Our Children's Trust, and with Witness. And our goal was to create 10 short films about young people who were suing their state governments. So these were the very first cases that Julia had brought to the first youth atmospheric trust litigation cases that she filed in the spring of 2011 on Mother's Day. And so we created these 10 short films focused on these young people's harms that they were experiencing in their home states. And that was really my introduction to working. That was the first time I had worked with young people. I mean, I was still at that time new to the film world, coming out of a career of the hard sciences. And it was, I fell in love with that, just kind of that relationship with young people and sharing their stories and uplifting their voices and providing a platform for their stories to be heard. Many of them do not have, the same advantages that older people have. And I was really drawn to their stories and to working with them and the kind of the uniqueness of, I guess, this type of storytelling.
So There's this moment early on in the film where you see this litany of presidents of the United States talking about the importance of caring for the earth, you know, in the interest of future generations. They're all sort of talking the talk. But one of the things that you've said, Christy, is that you tried really hard to create a film that wasn't partisan. Talk a little bit about the fact that we see in that litany of presidents who've talked the talk and not really been able to walk the walk yet, the Republicans and Democrats. So talk a little bit about the importance of that idea, this is not a partisan sort of question necessarily.
Yeah, I think, unfortunately, somewhere along the line, conservation and environmental issues, and in particular climate change, has somehow become a feature of the Democratic Party and not of the Republican Party, although the Republicans historically were the conservative ones. And, you know, I think it's really difficult, and we've seen the polarization that the topic of climate change has created in our societies, particularly in the United States. And I don't see this as a partisan issue. This is really an issue that, first of all, it affects all of us. It doesn't matter what party you belong to, you're going to be impacted by climate change. And it doesn't matter if you believe in the science or not, it's happening. And, you know, I was really struck by how Julia built out this case and, you know, the evidence that they had gathered, and you know, for them, the heartbeat of the case is really that, you know, as Julia mentioned earlier, the affirmative actions that the government has taken over decades to harm this youngest generation's future. And if you go back in time and you actually look at the evidence and you look at how our administrations have acted, it was truly both parties across the board. All administrations have failed us in this regard. And, you know, I think to some degree there were external forces. You know, it's unfortunate that during the Carter administration, while he was very busy working on renewables and conservation and, you know, all of these wonderful advances, at the same time, we had the oil crisis, and the decisions that his administration made were to beef up our coal production in the U.S., you know, rather than to put all of that energy towards renewables and towards a sustainable future. So I think it's really helpful for the discourse and for the conversation for people to understand that this is not, you know, this is not something that President Trump did solely. This is not something that President Bush did solely. You know, Obama was the president who, you know, made the United States the largest oil and gas producer in the world. And without having that knowledge and that understanding of what our government has done, it's really hard to move the conversation forward. So this was really crucial to me that the audience can learn this about our past administrations, because we no longer have the time for the rhetoric. The rhetoric is not getting us where we need to go. We actually need the actions to be behind these words.
So I want to ask you about, Julia Olson, I want to talk to you about this first element of standing, the harm on the plaintiffs. And there's this moment when you get this ruling from U.S. District Judge Ann Aiken, who says, she writes, "I have no doubt a right to a climate system capable of sustaining human life is, as she puts it, fundamental to a free and ordered society." Talk a little bit about the importance of that ruling, because she's recognizing for the first time this is a right. Talk about the significance of that.
Yeah, I mean, that was an incredibly powerful moment. It's the first time any judge has made that kind of ruling, certainly in the United States, but I think also in the world, really tying the right to a stable climate system and one that can sustain us in the way that humans have been sustained for thousands of years, embedding that in our fundamental unalienable rights was just transformative. And And the reason she used that language about a free and ordered society is when our courts look at our rights to life and liberty under the Fifth Amendment or the 14th Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, they are looking at those rights in part from a historical framework and in part from what it means to have this concept of ordered liberty. And so a lot of that analysis really goes back to the time of our founders and what kind of nation and government and protection of rights those people were trying to provide for the future. And one of my favorite quotes that we have used in the litigation comes from James Madison, who in 1818 said that the atmosphere is the breath of life without which we all perish. And he was actually talking about climate change in 1818 because of the vast deforestation that was happening. And these men were farmers and they understood the consequences of that. So to have her really, you know, go through that analysis and make those findings under our Constitution was just groundbreaking.
That was important for you to make that connection to the founders, to the idea of a constitutional right.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we argue in the case that these young people have other already recognized rights that are being infringed. So our right to personal security in the United States is deeply embedded in the Fifth Amendment. And so we allege a violation of that right to their personal security. So even without the newly recognized right, the case can move forward. But the recognition of that climate right is really important. It centers the case on what it's all about. And so it's a really important part of that initial 2016 ruling that then carries us forward for the next several years.
That's Julia Olson. She's chief legal counsel for the plaintiffs in the case Juliana versus the United States, along with the director Christy Cooper. Her film is Youth v. Gov. You can see the documentary on Earth Day. That's next Thursday night. This is part of our monthly film series with the Utah Film Center. You can get information on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Hi, it's Caroline Ballard, your local host of All Things Considered on KUER. Whether you made a one-time gift or became a new sustainer, the donations you've made during our spring fundraiser have been adding up. We're humbled to see how communities across Utah come together to say we value public radio. Thank you so much for supporting NPR Utah. If you haven't given yet, we welcome your gift at KUER.org/donate.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we continue our documentary series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. We're talking about the film called Youth v. Gov. It's about a lawsuit filed by these young Americans, teenagers mostly, when it all began. And it makes this novel case about climate change. The film is about the legal case and the stories of the kids making it. I wanted to ask Christy about some of the, when you're talking about the harm on the plaintiffs, we have to tell the stories of some of these plaintiffs, which you do, of course, in the film. Let's talk about some of the young people. Let's talk about Kelsey first. Kelsey Juliana, as you say, the named plaintiff in the suit. You tell a bit of her story, that she got her self-image from the activism of her parents. Talk a little bit about that. Her parents were pretty good role models in that way.
Yeah. So Kelsey is from Eugene, Oregon. She grew up with parents who were fighting to protect the old growth forests in the Cascades. And they were very heavily involved in these protests, in the sit-ins, were really part of the group that was able to ultimately protect this old growth forest. So, you know, Kelsey was kind of steeped in, I guess, the activism world growing up from a very young age, and understood what the importance of speaking out and standing up for the things that you love and what that means. And it was very interesting when we started working. The first time I started filming with Kelsey back in 2011, she was 16 years old. Is that right? 16? No, she must have been 15 years old. And her parents were very wary of us filming with her. They knew, you know, it had not always been an easy life for them as activists. And there were threats that were made to their lives. And there were, you know, there was a lot of negative things that happened and challenges that they faced by taking that role. And they were fearful of Kelsey being exposed to those similar things. And in particular, being a plaintiff in a lawsuit, they were very wary about what kind of influence or, just negative impact that it could have on her life. So that was really interesting to come from parents who had like completely thrown themselves in the front of the bulldozers and the cameras and had no fear about that, but that they were fearful of their daughter, taking on some of those similar roles. And I saw Kelsey, you know, from that period of being 15, to, you know, she was 19 when this case was filed, of kind of growing into her own role, and climate change really became the topic that she was most concerned about and cared about. And she continued to, you know, learn and from her parents and be able... The great thing is that she had a family who understood these challenges and understood that she needed the support in order to do that work. I don't think that every plaintiff has necessarily had that advantage that Kelsey had. And, you know, she comes from a city that is also steeped in activism and in environmental protection. And so she, you know, she had a very strong community around her when she started out in this work. And I think that's really been, you know, a huge foundation for her.
So let's talk about the second part of standing, which is represents Act Two in the film, the idea of who caused this. And that gets us to the history. And it's something, Julie, that you talk about in the film. You say that this trial is about letting that history out. Say a little bit about this. When did the government first start getting the information about the fact that there was change, drastic, terrifying, or least concerning changes in climate?
We did a lot of research. We had members of our team go to all of the presidential libraries, going back all the way to, I think, Eisenhower was perhaps the first of the presidential libraries that we visited. And we gathered as much evidence as we could. And so, I mean, what's clear is that climate scientists knew from, you know, at least the late 1800s, that if we burned fossil fuels, it would release greenhouse gases, primarily carbon dioxide, and that the increase in those gases in the atmosphere would heat the planet. And by the 1950s here in the US, our military, primarily the Navy, is sort of taking the lead on this research. And you can understand why, right? There's great implications for the Navy and the work that they do in terms of the ice in the Arctic and sea level rise and so forth. But by 1965, one of the biggest reports comes out, and this is during the Civil Rights era. This is Lyndon B. Johnson. And just such a fascinating time in history. And, you know, interestingly, Johnson's wife, the first lady, she was deeply concerned about environmental issues. And so I've always wondered what the connection was there. But they issue a report from the White House about pollution. And there's an entire chapter dedicated to atmospheric carbon dioxide and climate change. And
this is in 1965.
And they're projecting in that report that we're going to see the acidification of oceans. We're going to see sea level rise and drastic changes. And by the year 2000, like, we got to have this under control. And that was really the biggest piece of early evidence that we could point to, because after that, every presidential administration is being advised by its science advisors, we have to deal with this. We have to deal with this now. We can't wait. And, you know, by President Nixon's time, he's really looking at the electric car as a solution to this climate change problem. And he has his advisors saying, we're going to lose Washington, D.C. We're going to lose New York City to 10 feet of sea level rise. Wow. We have to act now.
I have to say, the there was this, of all the significant dates, it seems like the one that I that sticks with me from the film is 1971. Because this idea,
because it was the year that Julia was born.
I was born that year.
That was it, Julia.
Both of us were born that year, actually.
Oh my gosh. Because you say, as you just mentioned, Julia, that Nixon was, as you say in the film, all about the electric vehicle. And I think a lot of people are going to be surprised by Nixon's kind of progressive ideas about the environment, or at least the talk that he talked. And one of the things you mentioned, Julia, is we could have been on a totally different pathway. Like, this was a really critical moment in our history.
Yeah. I just turned 50. And when I think about the climate crisis, I really think of it as a half century old problem that we just completely sunk ourselves with. And I mean, if they really had this moment, many, many moments in throughout those presidential administrations to put us on a completely different path in terms of climate and how we power our energy systems and drive our cars and so forth. But imagine what that would have done to all of our international relations and the wars we might not have fought over oil. I mean, we would live in a very drastically different and better country and world had those people in power at those points in time really done something meaningful to shift course.
One of the really critical cases that you make, this idea, again, that the government acted affirmatively. It didn't just stand by passively. It controlled the system, facilitated the system, subsidized, promoted the system. And one of the things you convey in the film is that the government was concealing evidence, even altering reports, editing them, changing them. Say a little bit about that, and also just the, I guess luck is the way to put it, that you were able to find in people's basements a lot of these reports, a lot of these documents.
Yeah. I mean, one of the really beautiful things about this journey into the history is even though the people who were really in the positions of power to make a difference didn't, in my view, do what they should have, there were a lot of other people who were fighting like hell to do the right thing. And we interviewed so many people who were inside government during the 70s and the 80s and the 90s and beyond, who it was almost like a confessional for them. It was very cathartic for them to tell the stories of everything they did and how hard they tried to change the course of this big behemoth of the United States. And so there are amazing heroes in our history and inside our government who keep trying to do the right thing. And so I don't want, you know, this story to be a condemnation of everybody, because it's certainly not. And those people wrote reports and memos and provided us with a tremendous amount of evidence that is now being used in the litigation. So a really, really important part of that story.
And I would also add that there was, you know, as we kind of hinted at in the film, there was a lot of other actors behind the scenes as well who were influencing these policies and these decisions. And a lot of that was because of, you know, connections to the fossil fuel industry and lobbying groups. And, you know, so that was primarily what was the driving force to hiding the science and changing the science and changing the language, was really because it was not in the best interest of the fossil fuel industry.
Yeah. And, you know, one thing related to that, and it's, you know, a fact that maybe many people in Utah don't know, that the hydrofracturing technology, for example, you know, fracking, that was made possible by the research and development that the Department of Energy did. Wow. So our government spent a lot of money to really develop that technology and capacity. That's not something that the industry would have been able to do on their own. And so it's those kinds of partnerships and support that has really enabled our fossil fuel energy system to be what it is today. And, you know, there was certainly a time and a place for fossil fuels in our country. I don't want to say that, you know, we wouldn't be where we are today without them either. But it's more about once we had the knowledge of what it was doing to our planet and would do to our children and the capacity for an alternative energy system, you know, that's really when the rubber hits the road and you have to make a call.
So in the film, as it shows the progress of your case and the importance of establishing standing, that you show that these people have been directly impacted, you show who caused that harm. And then Act Three is about the courts, showing that the court system can and should provide a remedy. And this is the thing that's really fascinating and novel in some ways, because – and I wanted to – Julia, you start. Talk about the importance of the judicial branch playing a role here, because there's this moment in one of the presentations you're making to the court, to a federal panel of judges, and the judge is saying, look, you're asking us to do something that's different, that's unprecedented in some ways. So talk about the importance of the idea of the judicial branch playing a role in providing a remedy, because this is a really critical point in the film.
Yeah. So we obviously have three branches of government, and only one of those branches, and that's the judiciary, has the ability to declare rights and wrongs and to tell us whether something is constitutional or not. The political branches, the executive and the legislature, they can weigh in, but they don't get to actually make those ultimate legal conclusions. And so particularly, you know, in a case on behalf of children who, again, don't have any political power and are seeking a declaration of their rights and a declaration that the government has wronged them, only the courts can do that. And it's a really vital role that our courts have played throughout history. And, you know, one really obvious example, and it's discussed in the film, is Brown versus Board of Education, which is not just a civil rights case, but it's also a children's rights case. And in 1954, the Supreme Court issued an opinion, which has become a landmark famous opinion, of course, and it was only a declaration of law saying that segregation in our public schools is unconstitutional. And that was an enormous turning point. And it wasn't the only thing that was happening, obviously, but it was a really important turning point because prior to that, under the Supreme Court's prior precedent, segregation, keeping facilities separate for blacks and whites was considered lawful.
So this is about whether the judicial branch can play a role in dealing with global warming. Christy, you've said that the work that you've been doing and some other documentary shorts that get you, sort of, you were introduced to the importance of the judicial branch in all of this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I, you know, in the initial shorts that I worked on, that was my first introduction to understanding what the court's role is and how what the judicial branch's responsibility is in all of that. And I think in particular the Giuliana case, you know, it's expanded those other litigation cases much more broadly in terms of bringing in the constitutional elements to the case. And I certainly have learned a lot about how the role of our Constitution in protecting its citizens and the role that the court plays in upholding the law and upholding those constitutional rights.
Yeah, and Doug, you know, one thing that's really important in response to one thing you asked about, which is, you know, this is a really big thing, and the government has suggested that we're asking the court to do something it has never done before. And in some ways that's true, but in other ways it's not, because yeah. We're asking the court to perform its job. This is what it's empowered to do under the Constitution. And the argument, it's a little bit ironic, right? It's saying, look, we know we've done a whole lot to cause a lot of harm, and we've done it in many, many ways, but because it's so big, because our role in harming children is so large, the court should just stay out of it.
Yeah. Well, what's interesting too is the judge, in fact, that told you in that hearing, Julia, that you're asking them to do something, you know, difficult or unprecedented, he ruled against you. But in the end, the case was dismissed. They said the court doesn't have the power to intervene. They said that, yes, you'd been injured, but the federal court can do nothing, that it was beyond their power. And this is a really this is a setback, obviously, but you do get this really powerful dissent, and you spend a little time with this dissent from a judge named Josephine Staten. Do you want to say something about what she says? Because that does seem to be something of a powerful statement, maybe a legal opening in some way.
Absolutely. Judge Staten, she completely disagreed on this question of redressability. Is there something that the court can do, or must the court act? And she unequivocally says, yes, this is our job. And there are times when courts are looking at new constitutional questions, when an issue might not be ripe, or you might not have the right plaintiffs in front of you. And so there are times when courts will defer an important issue to another day and another case. But she ends on this really powerful note of, she says, my colleagues say that the time to review this case is never, and I say it's now. And future generations will look back and ask, why did so many do so little? And so the case is actually not over. We are back in the district court now. And yes, the Ninth Circuit said dismiss the case because the court can't issue the specific remedy that the plaintiffs requested, which was, we wanted the government to prepare a plan, a remedy.
Yeah, come up with a plan, right?
Come up with a plan, not a big deal. And so we have amended our complaint, the document that starts a case, and we have changed our request for relief to really focus on that initial declaration of constitutional rights and wrongs. Mm-hmm. And we just filed our reply brief last night. And so now Judge Ann Aiken will be making a decision about whether to accept this amended complaint and move us forward to trial. And interestingly, the Biden-Harris administration so far is following the same steps that the prior administrations took, and they are fighting that motion to amend.
What do you make of that?
I'm reserving judgment on that. I would hope that this administration would really take a deeper look at their legal position and see that, I mean, when courts have already found that there is injury and the government is a cause, and there's abundant precedent that courts can declare the rights and wrongs of the parties, that the administration might see the benefit of a court holding a trial and actually deciding those questions, because, you know, an ultimate ruling on the Constitution in this case will guide every future administration and the policies that will be deemed constitutional. And then the other thing that the administration can do is come to the settlement table. And we have that request out there and haven't had an answer to that yet.
Yeah. So let me ask you both, finally, the legal scholar Richard Primus says in the film that sometimes success depends on the relationship between the case and what's going on in the country, you know, like the larger movements. So are we in a movement where things are changing now? There's a different sensibility. People's attitudes about climate, about systemic racism, about all these, you know, are we in a moment now that gives you a sense that maybe something could be different this time?
I really think we are. I think we've been in that moment now for a while. During the civil rights era and Brown v. Board of Education, only 30% of Americans supported desegregation and really supported that movement. Mm-hmm. And right now we have, depending upon the poll you look at, you know, over 70% or maybe even higher of Americans who do care about the climate crisis and want to see something done about it. That's Democrats and Republicans. And then you see the youth movement around the world. We're working with youth in Utah to bring a case against the state government. We have youth around the country that we support in bringing cases and abroad. And these young people are not going to stay home and sit back and wait for the concentration of political power to decide their future. I think, Doug, that's one of the issues that may be different today is access and influence in that concentration of political power. It's not being held to account, perhaps, in the way it has been on other issues. And it's something that really needs to shift. And I think the courts play a vital role in making that shift happen.
Yeah. Christy, final word.
Yeah, I would agree with what Julia just said. We show this in the film, that so many other moments in history have paralleled what's happening. You know, what's happening in the courts has paralleled what's happening in the streets. And I do think that the time is very ripe for something very big to happen in our judicial system to move us forward with climate justice. I think we're very poised. I think we are at a moment in time where, you know, change is going to happen, and it's just a matter, I guess, of when.
Christy Cooper, Julia Olson, thank you both very much.
Thank you so much, Doug, for this opportunity. Thank you.
Christy Cooper, she directed the film Youth v. Gov. We also had with us Julia Olson. She's chief legal counsel for the plaintiffs in the case Juliana v. U.S. You can see the documentary on Earth Day. That's next Thursday night. This is part of our monthly film series, our partnership with the Utah Film Center. You can get details about the screening on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter @RadioWest. Our intern is Aaron Camargo, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.